This is an ABC podcast.
The first film ever made shows a group of workers, mainly women, streaming out of a factory at the end of the day. It's 1895, so they're wearing long skirts and big hats, and they're laughing and waving to one another. A dog wanders into the frame and back out again. A man wearing a boater gets on a bicycle and rides off. Nothing much happens in this 45 seconds, but the whole thing is extraordinary. It's the birth of cinema, the art form that changed the way we saw ourselves and went on to dominate the 20th century. Dominic Smith is a novelist, and his new book, The Electric Hotel, delves into the world of early cinema. Dominic has spent many happy hours in the dark watching silent films, everywhere from university basements to Baroque Italian theatres. Hi, Dominic.
Hi.
Tell me who made that first film, the one of the workers leaving the factory.
So it was these two French brothers, the Lumiere brothers, Auguste and Louis. Basically, they their father had seen an Edison peep show at a kind of world's exhibition. And he came back to them and said, you know, I just saw this incredible invention, but if you can find a way to break down the peephole aspect of it and project it, this is going to kind of change everything.
Well, tell me first more about Edison's peep show. Like,
yeah, so,
how did that work?
So basically it was like it was called a kinetoscope. And you put in a coin and you turned a hand crank. And there was a viewfinder and you looked down into the viewfinder and there was a kind of a reel that would be progressed at, you know, whatever your hand rate was on the crank.
So it's just one person looking at
once. It's just one person at a time. So it wasn't really cinema as we know it, but it did kind of precede the invention by the Lumiere brothers. And so they invent this thing called a cinematograph, which is a totally different approach to solving the same problem of projecting images. And essentially it doubled as both a projector and a camera. And so leading up to that first exhibition in 1895 and then some in 1896, they went out and they just made a whole bunch of kind of slice of life. You know, they were called actualities. And so you saw not only the image of, you know, people leaving the factory at the end of a day, you also saw things like Auguste Lumiere's baby daughter eating breakfast, right? I mean, it was hardly like captivating narrative, but people were entranced by this. And so there were 10 of these short 45-second reels that were all shown, you know, in a Paris hotel basement.
So this was the first showing, the first showing of cinema.
Yeah, this is the first showing. Now, they had kind of, it was almost like a preview that happened to members of a photographic society. And in the novel, I kind of dramatize that and have Claude Ballard, the protagonist, go to that. But in real life, their first public exhibition was in the winter of 1895, where they show, I think there's maybe 20 people in the audience, these 10 reels. And there's people are electrified by them, you know, for complicated reasons. But the if I could distill it down to one thing, it's basically that what they see on the screen is a transcript of real life. And it's totally mesmerizing. You know, what's come before is, you know, there have been magic lantern shows where you can have an image repeated on a screen. You've had, you know, you can put a photograph on a wall. But to see, you know, a woman and four boys running out along a pier and jumping into the ocean, and to see all the little, you know, the ripples on the waves and the leaves fluttering in the trees, that was totally new. Not to mention a train coming into a station that made people literally jump out of their seats.
Really?
Yeah, and get on the floor.
Because they thought there was something coming out of the screen.
It was like they had no perceptual preparation for that kind of experience. And so it was totally new. And George, you know, Méliès, who was like this photographer and the guy who's kind of popularized in the Hugo movie, was in that first audience. And he has a quote about just basically when these reels were over, people were just silent. They didn't know. They didn't know what they'd just seen, but they knew that everything was different.
Why were the films so short, Dominic?
So a lot of that just has to do with the technical, how many feet of film you could hold on the spooling mechanism that was on the cinematograph. Later, they obviously worked out how to splice film and have bigger magazines on the cameras. But those early ones, they were pretty crude and was just basically one continuous stretch of celluloid. And that was about what you could fit on there.
And it's almost the same mechanism. I think the Lumieres took inspiration from their mother's sewing machine, that way of kind of cranking stuff through.
Yes, and this was one of the early problems of film is like, how do you propel the film at a constant rate but things are actually moving inside the camera at different speeds. So you have to have this way in which the frames are moving in front of the source of illumination, but you're not kind of overstretching and putting too much tension on the film on the back end. And so they created a mechanism where there's some slack that's taken up that pull the frame in front of the lamp at just the right kind of moment.
What kind of relationship did the Lumiere brothers have with one another? Were they both inventors?
They were. I mean, they're interesting, right? So I went to the Lumiere child, their childhood home, and which is now a museum in Lyon. And you could tell that they were not only famous, they were very wealthy. And that's because they owned a photographic plate business in Lyon. That was the family business. And in fact, that first movie of workers leaving at the end of the day was taken at their factory. And so I got to kind of stand in the place where the very first movie was made, which was obviously hallowed ground. But they had a very, one was more the kind of business manager type. The other one was more the inventor. And they had a very symbiotic relationship. But there's one image that really stays with me in the Lumiere home, which is this picture, and I think it's Louis Lumiere, in a winter scene outside the family mansion, and he's walking a pet lion. and when I saw that, I couldn't wrap my head around. I was like, what does this mean? Like, there was something about it that made me think they were kind of living like, you know, the kings of hip hop in the 1890s, that they had this like imported pet lion.
Chugging champagne, yeah, and walking lions.
Exactly. Like, they had a very kind of interesting world that they created in Lyon, and they were not Parisians, you know, they were outside.
How did they try to turn this new invention into a commercial enterprise?
Yeah, well, so interestingly, if you look at that side by side with Edison, it's kind of a lesson in cultural approaches, right? Because what the Lumiere brothers do is they, you know, after the success of this first exhibition, they go out and they hire about 24 concession agents to travel the world evangelizing their invention. So the cinematograph, remember, is both camera and projector, which means that their concession agents, as they're traveling, not only show iconic sites of Europe, but they also get to make films of the local attractions and show them to the people that they're interacting with. And so it becomes this kind of mission to evangelize, but actually the copyrights and the patents on their mechanisms were not really well thought out or well protected. And so very quickly, there is like 20 different versions of a cinematograph in the UK and other places. Whereas what Edison did is he had more or less invented the kinetoscope, but he quickly realized when he saw the Lumiere invention, like, okay, that's what the future is going to be. Like, it's going to be this communal cinematic experience. So he found a way to bring in some pieces of the puzzle that he didn't own, but he bought the rights to. And then he developed the Vitascope. And the Vitascope was kind of the warring apparatus right next to the cinematograph. And over time, what you see is that Edison becomes very savvy, that's one way to look at it, about protecting his cinematic turf. And the Lumieres are a little bit oblivious. There's a famous quote by Louis Lumiere that the cinema is an invention without a future. And if one of the two brothers who invents the machine says that, it kind of gives you an idea that they thought that this would be an interesting flash in the pan.
So more like a novelty, yeah, than an ongoing art form.
Yes.
When they were sending out these concession agents, how far around the world did they travel?
Oh, it was incredible. So they sent them to America, South America, Cuba, Mexico, China, India, and Australia.
And so they would have been bringing back the first images that people who hadn't traveled had ever seen at those places?
Many times. I mean, often they had seen daguerreotypes or photographs, but certainly they were seeing, in most cases, the first moving images that they're encountering that for the first time. And so they had this kind of zeal about bringing the message of cinema, which was a visual message, and taking it to, you know, the far corners of the world.
Where would they show those cinema films?
They would often be in assembly halls, They would be in commercial, you know, in hotels that had, you know, auditoriums. They would rent space. I mean, Marius Sestier, the concession agent that came to Australia, he actually set up, you know, a short-term cinema in Pitt Street, right opposite City Tattersalls Club, where basically he rented a space, and he and his business partner showed Lumiere-style reels out of this, you know, this business for about 6 months.
Incredible. What kind of reaction did he get?
There are still kind of write-ups in I think, the Sydney Morning Herald and some other places. I mean, people were totally mesmerized. Now, at the same time that the Lumieres are doing this, Edison is also sending agents overseas. And so in Pitt Street, there was like an Edison projector, you know, like a, you know, place where you could see both, Vitascope projected reels as well as the kinetoscope peep shows. And then, you know, half a block later, you have the Lumiere. I think it was called Salon Lumiere. And that was actually, Salon Lumiere was really considered Australia's first cinema, even though it was temporary. In terms of cinema as we know it, that was where it started.
Does it have any of the things that we assume early cinema had, like, you know, nice seats and popcorn and music?
It's hard to know, actually. There weren't a lot of descriptions of, like, what it was actually like inside. It was mostly just about the reels. But concessions were a part of the early cinematic experience because it had kind of evolved through the vaudeville tradition, especially in America. And so there were certainly, you know, I don't know if it was popcorn or kettle corn or whatever, but there were things, people were serious about making money from you while you were there. And in fact,
nothing's changed.
No, absolutely nothing has changed. And there was, you know, I think there's coverage of people lining up outside, and they would just show continuous. It would be a 30-minute show of multiple reels. People would leave and the others would enter, and it would just go all day and into the night. And, you know, thousands upon thousands of you know, Australians went to see their first, you know, cinematic experience that way.
Tell me more about the concession agent who came to Australia.
So Marius Sestier was a pharmacist turned concession agent, and he was sent by the Lumiere brothers first to India. And he actually traveled with his wife. And in India, they met an Australian photographer, a man named Henry Walter Barnett. And I don't really know whether Australia was always in their plans or, you know, Barnett convinced them to come to Australia. But late in 1896, they all come back and they set up shop, as it were, in Sydney. As far as we know, the very first film that was made was, I think the French title is Le Patineur Grotesque. But basically, it was like it was this tradition of burlesque roller skating.
What?
Now,
what?
It sounds raunchier than it is. it's not actually burlesque as we think of it. This was essentially a man street performer, typically on roller skates, dressed in a big overcoat and a funny hat and smoking a cigar and maybe a little bit of face paint. And the first film is this gentleman skating around in a circle with a crowd around him in Prince Alfred Park. And there's, you know, the kind of the gag of the 45-second reel is that he has a big white hand painted on his bum, right? And so as he does these pratfalls...
This is our noble contribution to the origins of cinema, is it?
Well, then they also go and film the Melbourne Cup. So between those two things, that is kind of the origins.
This burlesque roller skating, which is my new favorite genre.
I know.
What kind of reaction did that one have?
So that one is really interesting. Even though it was Australia's first film, it was not shown in Australia till nearly a century later.
Why not?
Well, this film was shipped back to Lyon. It was shown in Lyon, and then it kind of disappears. I don't know that you could call it a lost film, but basically it reemerges in the 1960s in a Hungarian film archive. And there's, you know, a decade or so later, there's a research intern who's working at the Australian Film and Sound Archive who makes the connection that this film, there was some exhibition and you know, I think she had basically made the connection that this was an Australian film. And it wasn't until, I want to say 2010, that the film was repatriated to Australia, restored, and the descendants of Marius Sestier were flown out
That's
to Canberra for its first real exhibition in Australia, you know, more than a century after it was made.
And just 45 seconds or so of this guy roller skating.
Yeah. And that was the very first one. And then there were a lot of Melbourne Cup reels. I think there were maybe four or five. And then there's, you know, film of people getting off the ferry, the SS Brighton in Manly. So again, very simple, you know, non-narrative films, but totally unlike anything that people had experienced.
It seems amazing that a researcher in Australia could identify that film was the one that was made here.
I know.
Incredible. Because would these be named and
some
tagged?
Of them, yeah, some of them. So the big issue in silent film is often that these films had foreign releases. And when they went into foreign release, they were given foreign titles and foreign intertitles, if they had any, more later when the films got above 45 seconds. But so sometimes things are sitting in archives, but no one is connecting the dots. And sometimes things are sitting in archives and they don't even know that they have it there. And so this is a kind of, you know, modern day sleuthing kind of operation for silent film buffs. And people who are interested in this is that you can find films that have been neglected in an archive somewhere. And if you find the fragments, you can restore them and put them back together and show them sometimes for the first time in nearly a century.
There was an early film made about Ned Kelly here in Australia too, wasn't there?
There was. In fact, the story of the Kelly Gang, I think 1906, it's often considered the first feature film in the world, which is an important contribution of, you know, Australian film. I think it's Charles Tate and other family members who make this film. And this is a huge success, this film. And kind of legendary because it had been lost and found and fragments and there's different versions and people argue about like what is the definitive version, but most of it is now viewable. But it had such an impact that about 5 years after that film came out, there was a ban on bushranger narratives in several Australian states.
Why?
That actually stayed in effect till the early 1930s.
Because it was going to inspire people.
Yeah, exactly. So the sentiment was that somehow if you were propagating bushranger narratives in these silent films, you were kind of inciting the criminal class, right?
Well, I mean, it's like a version of kids in video games now. Like if they're watching stuff on screens, does that send you out to do the real thing?
Exactly. So even though it was very successful, you know, and there were some follow-ups about bushrangers, it was kind of quickly shut down as a public menace, that whole franchise.
Well, we maybe should get back on the statute books. So the Lumiere brothers, who were so pivotal in inventing this technology, decide it's just a flash in the pan. Did they ever try to make longer, what we would think of as feature or narrative film?
No. Their concession agents, as far as I've been able to find, didn't really... some of them may have gone and worked at like Pathé and some other that were and became prominent in feature film production. But the Lumières themselves quickly lost interest.
Went back to their pet lion.
Went to the pet lion and feeding the baby breakfast out at the family estate. And so what happens after the Lumières really becomes, and in the novel, the kind of battleground for how, you know, you may have invented this thing that revolutionizes the way people view themselves in relation to the world, but that doesn't mean you can control how it's commercially made available to them.
Though Edison did his best, didn't he, in terms of suing people and attempting to keep a control on that.
He did. So Edison was, I think, often labeled as the Wizard of Menlo Park, right? He was this iconic inventor, very wealthy. But he came to film pretty late, and he quickly realized, his great skill in many ways was not just as an inventor, but appropriating other people's inventions or the breadcrumb trail that would lead to something that was really important. And he realized that actually with motion pictures, what mattered was controlling how the film was made and how it was distributed. And so by 1908, he forms with a bunch of, most of the studios, the Motion Picture Patent Company. And this is basically a lockdown. It's a land grab. And at one point, Edison tried to patent how many perforations per frame you could have in a reel of film.
Why would he want to patent
well,
that?
So interestingly, the cinematograph and the Lumiere's invention only ever had 2 perforations per frame. And actually, that was inferior. You needed more stability. So 4 was better. Edison knew that. There were competing rail gauges in the US for a long time. So there was like a narrow gauge and a standard gauge.
Here in Australia still,
yeah,
I think.
Right. And so the same was true in celluloid. Right. So there was the Lumiere style reel, which was 2 perforations. They're both about 35 millimeters wide. And there was the Edison style, which was 4. Edison was very smart about kind of galvanizing his patents and copyrights and lawyers into getting control. So after the motion picture patent company comes into existence, basically it becomes illegal to import celluloid that is not made by the Eastman Kodak company. It becomes the only way to show a motion picture in America after that point is to rent them, even if you're a cinema owner. Before, you used to be able to buy the reels. So the whole system kind of got on lockdown. And at its height, Edison would send private detectives out to other people's film shoots, especially in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which was kind of the hub where all this was happening, to make sure that no one was infringing his copyright and his patents. And people would routinely cover up their cameras in case the, you know, Edison's men came around.
In the early years of actual silent films, where they moved from these 45 seconds or so to longer narratives, were they always shown with music, Dominic? Was that part
that
of the...
That came later. You have these early 45-second reels. They start getting longer. They start getting more narrative. But the very first ones before there are dedicated feature films are shown in vaudeville houses. And actually, they were called chaser reels. And the chaser reel, its primary function was to clear the auditorium between live acts. And so that gets people moving out of the auditorium. The next audience comes in. So in that environment, there may have been some music, but it wasn't music that was necessarily built for the film. So it's really later... at its height, I mean, by the time you get to 1915 and D.W. Griffith and the big epics, he's commissioning these massive scores that go along with, you know, a 3-hour film.
Were the early developers of the cinema technology ever trying to use sound, or was that just seen to be too hard?
They were, actually. So it's interesting, and it wasn't Edison, which would be the natural, you would think, well, with all his phonograph experiments and inventions, surely that would be a natural, but... There was the world's first female director, a woman named Alice Guy Blachet, was a French woman. She had her own studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey, called Solax Studios. At one point, I think it was in upstate New York. But she was doing early experiments with sound, decades before sound became a viable kind of methodology within film. So they were trying to solve it. And they also would create these elaborate kind of sound effect machines. I think there was something called it may even be in the book, but it's like a soundograph or something, where it stored different kinds of special effects. So they knew that sound was a kind of inevitability, but no one had been able to work out how to synchronize sound with the movement in the right way.
So until they could do that, they were using those speech cards or intertitle
right.
cards. How often would they show up in
It really depended on the film. But I mean, I think if it's a fast-paced, dialogue-laden scene, you might see a patch where there's 12 title cards in the span of a couple minutes. But then you might have a whole sequence that was very visual and there was no intertitle cards. And so interestingly, when these films get rediscovered and restored, you're often having to go back and rewrite the original English intertitle card because now the one surviving version has like the Danish or whatever. And that's kind of this added kind of piece of the puzzle.
Thinking about the early film actors, they came from stage, I assume. What kind of acting style did they bring with them into cinema?
So I think in the very early days, so pre kind of 1905, it's mostly the Victorian model of stage acting. So, the Sarah Bernhardt kind of very big, elaborate gestures built for a big auditorium. What's interesting is that by 1907, you start to have this rise of naturalism And more realistic approaches. And that actually parallels inventions that are happening in the camera. So close-ups, for example. Well, if you can do a close-up...
So that wasn't there
at the beginning. No, in fact, the early cameras had a fixed focal length. You basically put the camera on a tripod. The actors are moving as if it's a play, pretty much staying in one, you know, depth of field. And only later, the focal length's changing, and then even later still, you're actually starting to do close-ups that signify something. And so the acting styles changed as a matter of course.
Because you don't want to be big when you're having a close-up.
I wonder it could be a little terrifying.
Like that locomotive coming out of the out of the screen. I wonder if audiences took a little while to catch up with those different styles of acting.
I think they did. I mean, you know, the early experiments with the close-up, and film scholars don't quite agree on exactly who had the first close-up. But when you see it, it's usually things like a close-up of a handwritten note, close-up of a face. And they're still trying to work out how to use it and not disrupt the narrative, how to not make it feel like you're in a different space entirely. And that's all part of film grammar emerging. We take for granted now, you know, what a close-up means. But of course, you have to be trained, you know, visually to know that, oh, it's just a different perspective on the same continuous
it's not
narrative.
Not suddenly a giant has appeared in this story.
Exactly.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
I'm curious about those early silent films. You know, when I watch clips of them now, they're so jittery. It's like everyone's slightly sped up. Is that how cinemagoers would have seen them at the time?
Yes and no. So it turns out that, you know, the kind of jittery, accelerated look and feel that we associate with silent film is mostly the result of a technical fault. So remember, these cameras are hand-cranked. The projectors are hand cranked. So being able to keep a very continuous frame rate is really challenging. They're also, in some commercial settings, a deliberate attempt to speed up the films, especially things that were kind of slapstick comedy. It kind of made them funnier, right? And so there is this kind of feeling of like everyone is walking 20% faster before 1927 than they do now, because they're doing kind of slapstick comedy. But that was not the intention. The intention was to show naturalistic movement, to show it the same way that it appears to us in real life. And so the big breakthrough for me in a book like this and with material like this is when I had the experiences of actually seeing films perfectly restored, perfectly rendered, things moving very naturalistically, it's an entirely different experience. And you start to realize that, in a way, those old silent films suffer from this kind of visual stereotype. And it's part of why we've dismissed them a little bit culturally. You know, they're kind of, you know, if you ask the average person in the street, what do you think of when you think of silent film? I mean, maybe they'll say, German expressionism.
But depends what street you're walking down, if that's what they answer.
Yeah, exactly. But more likely, they're going to be
Chaplin,
like, you know, yeah, Charlie Chaplin or like these zany, you know, Keystone Cops kind of actions. And that sped up quality is often what comes to people's mind. So it was a revelation to realize like that isn't necessarily part of it's not baked into the DNA of early film.
You mentioned that a lot of these early films were being made in a place called Fort Lee in New Jersey. Why was that of appeal to early filmmakers?
Yeah, so Fort Lee, you know, was really America's first movie town, and it's right across the Hudson River from Manhattan. And Fort Lee as a town offered a lot of things to filmmakers, including a variety of filming locations. So you could film, you know, Civil War battles out on the fields. You could film your damsel in distress melodramas out on the clifftops. In fact, you know, Fort Lee essentially popularized the idea of the cliffhanger ending literally because of the kinds of reels that they made out on the Palisade clifftops.
Truly.
Yeah. Yeah. So they didn't really invent the cliffhanger, but they brought it into the vernacular in a way where people knew what that meant. And that ending, that style of ending of literally, you know, a damsel in distress hanging by, you know, one hand at the edge of a cliff, became a way to get people back into the theater the following week to pay their quarter or whatever it
was. So they were made like serials, like Dickens novels.
A lot of serialized films. And you could also film westerns over there. And so Fort Lee developed as, you know, this movie town that had about 8 or 9 studios.
Actually were filming inside in studios as
later.
Well?
Later. So they filmed outside, they filmed inside. They developed elaborate kind of production stages over there. I mentioned Alice Guy Blaché. She had a studio over there. And so places like Universal and Paramount and Fox all began in Fort Lee. And in a lot of ways, I mean, there is World War I, which had a profound influence culturally, obviously, once America entered. But also, Edison, because he put such a kind of stranglehold on kind of innovation in those early film circles, a lot of the European filmmakers left. And the Americans started going to Hollywood.
Why Hollywood?
So the weather was better. And you're also basically beyond the reach of Edison's lawsuits. And so, I've often thought while I was working on this book that if it hadn't been for Edison's litigious nature, you know, we might be going to Universal Studios in Fort Lee, New Jersey, instead of in Hollywood.
What's it like now? Is there any trace of that history, Dominic?
There's really very few traces. There is a Fort Lee Film Commission that kind of tries to keep the, you know, the legacy alive. The last building that was once a studio, I think, has now been knocked down. You see street names that are named after some of the early filmmakers and some of the studios. There's a few plaques, but it's really not a history that's widely known.
You know, it's easy to watch those early films from the Lumiere brothers on YouTube. They're really accessible. But how many of the feature films from the silent era still exist?
Yeah, so they say roughly that there were about 10,000 silent films made. And so we've lost about 7,500 of those. So, you know, 3/4 of them. So you have about 2,500 or so that are in archives, in circulation, they've been digitized. And there's a small group of that that are just so fragile that no one's been able to work out the technology to actually duplicate them without actually further damaging the negatives or the celluloid reel.
Why have so many been lost?
So I think there's a couple factors. I mean, the most obvious one is the medium itself, right? So celluloid nitrate was the material they used for these early reels, super flammable and highly, it decomposes very readily. And so over the years, you have thousands of these films that either quietly dissolve in attics and basements and archives, or they go up in flames in studio fires, and they actually can like self-combust. I mean, these are dangerous. You know, there were lots of fires in early cinema.
Well, just because their chemical properties are
precarious. It basically build as it decomposes over time. It starts to generate, the possibility of you know, it bursting into flame. So studio fires was a big thing. I mean, in the 60s, there were at least a couple notable big studio fires. And so, you could lose 150 films in one day in a studio fire. And then conversely, I mean, interestingly, silent films show up in really weird places. There was a Charlie Chaplin film that was rediscovered, I think, in 2009 when someone sold an unmarked canister of film on eBay for $5. And it happened to be the only surviving print of a film that had been lost for, you know, a century. And in the Yukon Territory in Canada, in the 1970s, they were doing excavation and they basically found about 530 silent reels inside this decommissioned swimming pool. And it had been used as landfill. There's a great documentary about this by the filmmaker Bill Morrison. It's called Dawson City, Frozen Time. And it's the story of this gold rush town that it was on the end of the distribution chain for films. So when the films went up there, they were never sent back. right? And so over time, once sound came in and once this kind of gold rush town kind of went bust, they didn't know what to do with them. So they just started to use them like a landfill. They would just literally put them in empty space and build around it.
And they ended up in a swimming pool.
That's and so incredible. All these films were lost, were considered lost. And so Canada basically reclaimed over 500 lost films in a single day when they were discovered.
Why did you travel to Italy to see some of these silent films?
Why does one ever go to Italy? I mean,
surely you could have gone to the Yukon. Why Italy?
I know. So it happens that in northern Italy, in the town of Pordenone, which is about 90 minutes north of Venice, they have had, for the last 30 or so years, the world's biggest silent film festival. I heard about this through some connections, and I was like, oh, I absolutely have to go to that. So I went, and it's an amazing experience because, you know, what I love about this world of silent film is, like, just when you think it's totally neglected, it's all going to be vanishing very soon, you find these pockets of just total adoration for the medium. And so more than 1,000 people come from all over the world, and they almost come like pilgrims. And they descend on this town, Pordenone, and they go to this, you know, the Verdi Theater, which is a beautiful, restored kind of old theater. And they basically sit in the dark for a week and watch literally 12 hours a day. I'm not saying everyone goes to everything, but 12 hours a day of programming. And they watch these old silent ghosts kind of shimmer across the screen. And people are absolutely entranced. And what's especially amazing is that sometimes a restored film or a rediscovered film gets its, you know, it's not technically its debut, but it's a re-debut, right, at the festival. And so when I was there, a film conservationist had found and been able to reassemble 23 minutes of an early Louise Brooks film, which, as it turns out, belongs to a genre that was known as an aviation comedy.
Well, it still exists. Flying high. This is a long tradition.
Exactly. Exactly. So who knew that this is kind of where
it
started?
It goes all the way back.
Yeah. So Louise Brooks, before she's that becomes the iconic kind of flapper girl of the 1920s, is in this zany aviation comedy called Now We're in the Air, which she actually plays twins.
That's great.
Grisette and Griselle. And I think Griselle is the one in the tutu. And that becomes part of Louise Brooks's kind of iconic image. And so you got to see 23 minutes of this beautifully restored film that no one had really seen in 90 years. I think it had shown at San Francisco right before Pordenone. But essentially this totally rediscovered thing. And it's not about, you know, having watched this film and it was beautifully accompanied and the musical score was great, but it was not a lost masterpiece, right? It was kind of a little bit wacky. But what was extraordinary was this feeling, I mean, in the auditorium, it was like a new Martin Scorsese, you know, was opening. People were completely enraptured because you were about to see something straight from the vaults of history. And, you know, to see, you know, Louise Brooks had a pretty tragic postscript to her film career, and to see her in this moment of suspended time before all that, her fame and also her demise, to see all of that was really poignant and really powerful. So that was worth going to Italy for.
Tell me more about Louise Brooks' career, because it does seem to encapsulate so much of the kind of glamour and the tragedy of this period in cinema. How big a star was she?
She was big. I mean, her big masterpiece, I think, was at this German film called Pandora's Box. But she made 25 films, and she really was an iconic figure. So she was kind of largely, I think she made a few films in the sound era. But then she disappeared. She was briefly, there was a French festival circuit that was obsessed with Louise Brooks in the 50s. There's some quote about there was no Garbo, there was just Louise Brooks. Like, she was this very magnetic presence.
Well, when you look back at even not seeing her in a proper cinema, even just seeing her on a computer or television screen, she's totally alluring and charismatic. Yeah. I guess it's that black Bob and the white skin just seems
just
to pop out.
And just so natural and playful on screen. So there was this, you know, I remember, so after I saw her 23 minutes in Pordenone, I kind of went down this rabbit hole of finding out, well, what happened to her in real life? And not surprisingly, a la, you know, D.W. Griffith and some other people from the silent era, it ended pretty tragically. So in the 70s, the New Yorker sends their, theater critic, Kenneth Tynan, to see what's become of her. And so he travels to Rochester, New York, which is where Eastman Kodak House is and the museum. And there was a curator there who'd taken an interest in her life. And it turns out that after fading away, she worked as a sales clerk in a department store in Manhattan in Saks Fifth Avenue, found it harder and harder to kind of pay her way in New York. She was convinced by this curator to move up to Rochester. And by the time Tynan goes up there in the late 70s, she's frail. She's got kind of debilitating arthritis, and she hasn't left her two-room apartment in over a decade. So it's, you know, and there's this great quote, I think in the article is something she says to Kenneth Tynan, like, you know, I've been trying for 20 years to, you know, forget who I was, and now you're going to bring me back.
Such a sad end, because she was one of those. I think she'd been a dancing girl. She didn't come from theatre, so she was the naturalistic actress, because as she says, I was just being me on screen, you know, and that's what's captured, I suppose.
Yeah.
Was that common for actors who were big in silent films to find the transition into talkies to be quite difficult?
It was. That world is full of stories like, you know, D.W. Griffith. At one time, he was the world's most famous film director. His big epics, you know, Birth of a Nation, Intolerance, they kind of transformed what people thought was possible. Birth of a Nation especially was successful. But, you know, he basically died, you know, famously in the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel, which is in the novel, where he has a stroke under the chandelier in the lobby in the 1940s, I think in 48. And by that point, he was essentially completely forgotten by Hollywood. So he couldn't get work. And it wasn't that he, you know, people, it wasn't that he was seen as not having talent or skill anymore. There was something about the transition from silence to sound that made people a little bit uneasy. It was almost this patronizing, like, oh, wasn't that quaint? That before we didn't know how to synchronize sound with picture. And there was a slight kind of shame, I think, that this was the medium before then. And that's reflected in the lack of measures that people went to preserve these films. There's absolutely no reason why these films couldn't have been duplicated in all the years before they were, you know, many of them were destroyed.
Such different ideas about cinema and different ideas about kind of heroines as well. Like, I think about the innocent, the sort of ingenue in silent films gets totally eclipsed by vamps in the 30s, doesn't she?
Yeah, although that even starts like with actors like Theda Bara, you know, who's considered the first vamp. That starts in the silent era, and what you see is this weird collision course of, I feel like that becomes a crossroads in early film where, you know, in the world of theater, when the actor goes at the end and takes a bow, they relinquish the role. Right? In the world of film, they don't. So the credits might roll, but for those early audiences, they really had this perception that somehow the role and the person were really intertwined.
It wasn't all plush Italian cinema festivals that you were watching these films in, Dominic. Where else did you have to go to find the films that are left?
Yeah, so I went to the Library of Congress, which it's always weird to think of that, but because they became the early repository of these silent films, they happen to have the biggest collection. So I went to the one in DC and I spent many happy days watching films in the basement.
In the basement.
In the basement, which is kind of like this Cold War era looking just maze of white fluorescent corridors. But the real kind of fascinating place was there, kind of sister campus, which is in Culpeper, Virginia, town not in the middle of nowhere, but it's out there, where not only do they have, this is their preservation facility. So not only do they have this amazing state-of-the-art theater where they show a lot of restored silent films with live musical accompaniment and a curated lecture, but in the bowels of a former nuclear bunker, they store America's cinematic treasure. I mean, basically, you know, right down to the original camera negative of The Great Train Robbery, which was really the first narrative film, is stored down there. And the reason is that this nuclear bunker belonged to the U.S. Treasury Department. And during the Cold War, they would store banknotes and coins down there in case of a Russian attack, right? Now, after the Cold War ended, they wanted to repurpose this nuclear bunker. And so now it's stacked with these temperature-controlled, humidity-controlled reels that are all down in the kind of the bowels of this thing. In some cases, waiting for the technology to evolve so that they can be digitized and brought back to life.
What a fantastic setting. How many films do you think you watched while you were riding the electric hotel?
I mean, it's in the hundreds. I mean, but some of them are really short. So, you know, it sounds more impressive than it is. Some of them are, you know, 45 seconds long.
And do you have a favorite from those?
Well, what's interesting is that this is a little bit of a cheat, but there are a couple films that are actually at the very end of the silent era. So by the time people get to the end, I mean, interestingly, you would think, okay, 1927, sound comes in. Everything is in sound. No. People are still making silent films. There's a 1930 film, a German film called People on Sunday, which is one of my favorite films ever, totally naturalistic. It's about a group of friends hanging out on Sunday and having various adventures in, I think, Berlin. And Billy Wilder wrote the screenplay before he came to America. And it's just exquisitely shot. It's a great film. So that, for me, is one that, even though it's not kind of at the birth, it's almost like the benchmark of what silent films could do.
Can you imagine what that film would have been like if it had had sound? How would it have been a different film?
I think it would have been a lesser film. And this is what's interesting is that, you know, by the end of the silent era, what they've perfected is subtext, gesture. You're staying in physical spaces longer because still you're not kind of getting the same amount of editing that happens in sound. And so they really luxuriate in getting all the details right. So looking at the physical spaces of each, you know, sequence or scene, they're just built in a very careful, artistic and measured way. And I think it's really hard for me to imagine that film having, like, dialogue. It would break the entire spell.
The appreciation you have for the way those films were made, is that something that shaped the way you wrote the novel or tried to?
A little bit. I mean, so, you know, one of the things I thought about in how I wrote the book is that I wanted on the page there to be quite a bit of white space for a few reasons. One is I wanted it to kind of evoke early photoplays and also the intertitle cards and the treatment of dialogue that would happen. I wanted that to be mimicked. So in the book, there's no, you know, traditional quotation marks, for example. And I also wanted white space so that you got the feeling that each paragraph was a kind of encapsulation. And the other thing about white space is that this feels to me like a story that is coming out of these gaps and these silences. So I wanted to reflect that. And I also thought about how can you do less with words, especially dialogue, and how can you lean on subtext and gesture? And that was something that I felt like I rediscovered as a result of spending so much time watching silent films. I was like, you know, that scene was only 8 seconds long, and yet it revealed so much about the character. How can I do that in my own writing?
There's something also so poignant in these films because you're watching often young, beautiful people full of life and vitality and energy, and you know as you're watching them that everyone on that screen is gone.
Yeah. No, I think it is very poignant. I mean, you're watching sometimes the figures in the faces of people that existed most vividly for, you know, maybe our grandparents' generation or, you know, but there is this way in which it's a portal and it's a window into a very different time. And in that way, as someone who spends a lot of time thinking about history and the narratives that have come before us, there is not much out there that's as immediate kind of vehicle to get you there and to really see what it felt like to be alive. Because when you have a film like Now We're in the Air, it says something about that moment in time, you know, and it's a cultural artifact. And in that way, it's very revealing.
Dominic, I've loved learning about this period in cinema culture, and I loved your novel. Thanks so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Dominic Smith, and his book is The Electric Hotel. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.